I turn now to an interview with Patricia Kohlberg on a small but crucial group of activists, people we call citizen scientists. Patricia was medical director of Multnomah County for 20 years. In this first part, we address the age-old question, who watches the watchers? Who regulates the regulators?
The environmental movement has always needed citizen scientists. Back in the late 70s, when I was developing an environmental program for the labor movement here in the Pacific Northwest, there was a lot of science that I had to learn, as well as learning about the different regulatory agencies. I had to learn about, for instance, exposures, limits on exposures, chemicals workers in workplaces were exposed to, as well as the different jurisdictions, the difference between the occupational safety and health agencies, both state and federal, and the environmental protection agencies, both state and federal. The work that I was doing inside the workplace was in some ways simpler than much of the environmental movement on the outside of workplaces. We could see some of the consequences of, for instance, exposures, chemical exposures. When workers were handling pentachlorophenol, when they were working with wood preservatives and their dioxin contaminants, we could see, we could directly encounter the exposures, or the consequences rather, neural damage and reproductive damage, and we could intervene and change those practices. And when corporations claimed that they weren't using chemicals, again, that we knew that they were, we could sneak into the back rooms and expose their practices and their lies. Science was part of larger social issues then as it is now. Again, focusing on a workplace when women were barred from certain kinds of jobs because there were potential reproductive consequences for their exposures, we could intervene on grounds of gender discrimination. That is, if there were consequences for women, we knew there were consequences for men also. It was discriminatory to bar women from jobs. In effect, what I was doing was training citizen scientists. And by citizen, I meant two different ways. One is we were not people with science training, and two, we were understanding the science in a larger context, like I mentioned, issues of gender discrimination. Patricia Kohlberg has been both functioning as a citizen scientist and has been intrigued by the phenomenon of citizen scientists surrounding her in the environmental movement. Old mole Patricia Kohlberg, you've already had some training along the lines of science. Tell us a little bit about your trajectory.
Well, I do have training in both as a physician, and I have a master's in public health. And as part of that, I did do a little bit of environmental training, but I came into this work in the part of the environmental movement that is working against climate change with very little understanding of the kinds of scientific issues that I would be asked to evaluate. I've been working with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and I've become one of their science writers, which means that I help to read and evaluate usually permits that have been applied for by various fossil fuel corporations to the regulatory agencies like the Department of Ecology in Washington State or Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. What I've noticed is that there are a whole number of people in these communities that have been targeted by the fossil fuel corporations for these big projects like the liquefied natural gas project in Coos Bay or the methane to methanol refinery in Kalama, that there are people within those communities who are dismayed by what they see as a threat to their ways of life or a threat to the climate or their environment. And they have taken it upon themselves to educate themselves about the science of energy, the energy industry, which is very complicated, so that they could effectively challenge these corporations on this very scientific and technical terrain that would occur during the permitting process.
Do you think of these folks as, leaving yourself out of the question, as kind of heroes?
Well, they are. I mean, many of these people do not have formal scientific training. Some of them do, or some of them, for example, there's a woman in Kalama who has training as a mathematician. That's not the same as understanding the environmental science of the energy industry. It's a whole different field. And people have stepped into realms that are very difficult and technical to grasp.
Just like your medical training didn't equip you probably any more than it would have me to read an environmental impact statement.
No, when I first started looking at methane, you know, understanding the global warming potential of methane, I had to figure out what they were talking about there and what's the difference between the 20-year versus the 100-year global warming potential, and why does it matter, and why do people use one or the other? And it's confusing, and you have to take time to understand it.
Why? I mean, obviously, why to understand it, but why do we need civilians doing this? Why isn't this part of what the regulatory agencies are doing?
Well, basically, I think because the citizen scientists have had to step up and become the regulatory agencies for the regulatory agencies. We're the ones who are kind of checking on their work because, unfortunately, they have not been doing their job. They've been permitting these large transnational fossil fuel corporations to submit these technical pieces of permitting data which are not scientifically sound, which do not have scientific integrity. And it's fallen to the citizen scientists to reveal that and say, look, this isn't sound science, and you can't go forward with this permit when they're using this outdated metric from 20 years ago. This was updated 5 years ago, and we should be using that metric. As just one example.
I like the notion that citizen scientists are the regulators regulating the regulatory agencies. It's a national phenomenon, of course, this phenomenon of citizen scientists, but especially here in the Pacific Northwest. Why?
We are in the unfortunate position of being targeted by the fossil fuel corporations right now, both oil and gas.
And coal.
And coal as well, although we've fought that off. Actually, we've fought off quite a number of projects. We've been very successful. And I attribute a lot of that success to these citizen scientists who have stepped up to the plate. The issue in the Pacific Northwest is that we have abundant water, we have relatively cheap electricity, and we have ready access to overseas, particularly Asian markets. And these are the things that the fossil fuel industry really needs right now.
We know what the regulatory agencies are supposed to be doing. Why aren't they?
I believe that it's primarily political pressure. And it's political pressure that is being purchased by the fossil fuel corporations, not just the fossil fuel corporations, by the timber interests, by the transportation interests, by many large corporations in whose interest it is to put the brakes on any kind of regulation of carbon emissions.
Including by submitting what you've otherwise called junk science. I want to come back to the junk science issue, but focus still on the regulatory agencies. You're talking about direct influence on them by corporations. An indirect influence, of course, would be all the cutbacks in government resources, the resources that those regulatory agencies have. I'm struck by one of the consequences of those cutbacks, as well as of the influence, is how much the regulatory agencies rely on data furnished by precisely the entities, the corporations they're supposed to be regulating. This reminds me, incidentally, of a Grace Paley story where she tells about as a young bride on an army base. She is, she's in charge of the radio station or something like that, and every day at noon it's her responsibility to set a chime on the radio that will tell people what the exact time. And she does it by looking out the window and seeing the clock that's prominently displayed above the main building in the army base. And one day she finds out that that clock has been set regularly, that the criteria they use for deciding the time is the chime that she puts out over the radio. And so here you get the regulatory agencies regulating the chemical exposure, say, to stick with that kind of an example, based on precisely the data that the corporations are feeding back to them about what's safe.
Right. The usual story is that the corporation that's trying to push a particular project and wants to get these permits hires a firm to do its calculations, its projections, its measurements, and produce the data that will then go into the permit application. But they're the corporations are the ones who are paying the bill for that. And so they are the client of the agencies that are actually producing the information. So when they produce that information, they're going to produce the information, the data that their client wants to see. But there's even another aspect to that, which is that so much of this data is not even measured. It's actually calculated. For example, they will do these tests on a stack, and maybe they'll do that once a year at a predefined time when the facility knows that it's going to happen, so they can manipulate their production process however they want to do it. They come in, they make that one test, and then they project annual emissions through these mathematical formulas for the entire year. And there isn't any ongoing measurement of what's actually coming out of that stack except for this one time a year.
I remember that particular instance when you mentioned a stack. That's the incinerator.
Yeah.
North of Salem,
right,
along I-5. And you're talking about how DEQ in Oregon supposedly regulates the emissions,
right,
one time a year, and then we project for what it's going to be like for.
Just to be real precise, there are a few emissions that they measure on a continuous basis, but there are, 50, 100 toxic emissions that are spewing out of those stacks, and for all the rest of them, other than five or six of them, they're only doing either no measurements or just that one annual measurement.
We'll resume the interview after this reminder that Science is Real by They Might Be Giants.
Hello!
Hello!
We are They Might Be Giants.
And we want to welcome you to our musical laboratory. As the philosopher Rudolf Carnap once so clearly said,
Science is a system of statements based on direct experience and controlled by experimental verification.
Or as we say, science is real.
Science is real. From the Big Bang to DNA. Science is real. From evolution to the Milky Way.
In the second part of this interview with Patricia Kullberg, we talk about the premises and values that underlie science.
One other problem that you've pointed to within the regulatory agencies is that when they project into the future, when they think of alternatives, their premises are restricted to just the market itself. They don't take into account that there could be other ways of organizing a society, other ways of dealing with environmental problems. That too is an issue I want to come back to. Before we do that, can you walk us through a particular instance in detail? I have in mind, you've mentioned Kalama, so let's go with that. So here we are looking over an environmental impact statement submitted by the corporation. It's required by law to do that. What happens? What are the problems with it?
The Kalama methane to methanol refinery permitting process is now well into its sixth year. When it first started, they produced an environmental impact statement that had lots of problems with it, but one of the big problems was that they calculated the greenhouse gas emissions based on what the operation would produce just at the site. And of course, this is a big problem because the entire project is responsible for producing way more greenhouse gas emissions than what happens just on the site. And in fact, the calculation that subsequently came out showed that roughly of the total greenhouse gas emissions associated with this methane to methanol refinery, the site itself in Kalama only accounts for about 20% of those greenhouse gas emissions. The rest of it would be associated with the extraction of the gas, the transport, the storage, and then the end use of the product. All those activities produce greenhouse gases. And you can't just count the little bit, you know, that you want to count. It's sort of like saying the donuts that I eat at work don't count because I don't eat them at home, so those calories don't count. Well, that's ridiculous on the face of it. So there was a big fuss made about that, and the company was told it had to go back and produce what we call a life cycle analysis that would take into account all those greenhouse gas emissions. So they did that.
Pause for just an instance to emphasize the point you just made, which is it took mass protests to get them to do that life cycle analysis. And here is where the citizen scientists have an impact.
Yes, precisely. So they came back with their so-called life cycle analysis and made this claim that their operation would actually result in a net reduction in global greenhouse gas emissions. And they managed to produce this so-called scientific result by pulling, you know, two sort of tricks. One is that they used all these outdated metrics.
Wait a second. Just to cement that image in my mind. So here's a process that's based on fracking and on shipping with all its leakages and on producing methanol.
And plus the end use of the methanol was to make plastic in China.
And all of this is going to have a positive impact on greenhouse gas emissions.
Right.
On climate change.
Right.
Essentially.
Right.
We're contributing
yes.
to stopping climate change by doing all this.
That's correct.
That's their science showed this.
That, yeah. And the two tricks were using all this junk science to way, 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 way tamp down on the greenhouse gas emissions, to really undercount. And the second was to use their basis of comparison, a process that was using coal to produce plastics. So they're using the very lowest standard and a process that the world needs to move away from and is moving away from into, I mean, there are alternatives for producing plastic. There are also alternatives in terms of cutting down on the amount of plastic that we need. And you don't need to use as your standard, you shouldn't be using as your standard the absolute worst business as usual kind of scenario. So those were the two kind of tricks they used.
Well, I recall a further trick, actually, which is a difference between how the project was presented to the regulators and to the public and how it was presented to their shareholders.
Yes. They basically were saying, as late as 2019, they were saying to the regulators that this methanol was going to be 100% used in the manufacturing of plastics. It was not going to be diverted for use as a fuel.
Which
in
would
China.
Have even greater environmental impact, if so.
2.6 times more greenhouse
Worse.
Gas emissions associated with methanol when it's used as a fuel. So that would really throw their numbers off. So they said, oh, we're not going to permit that to happen. It's only going to be used for plastics. At the same time they were telling regulators this, they were telling their investors there is this burgeoning market for methanol as a fuel in China, and we're going after that market. That information was leaked to Columbia Riverkeeper and published by OPB. Northwest Innovation Works, which is the Chinese company that is trying to build this project, they were the ones that were essentially lying to regulators about their intentions for what they were going to do with the methanol.
Yeah, essentially doesn't even need to be said. They were out and out lying. In other words, submit whatever passes for science that's necessary to get the plant built, and then there's nothing anybody can do about it after that. You sell the product how you want and
Correct.
To whom you want. And okay, let's look more closely at the science then. What do you mean by junk science?
Well, I mentioned one already, is that you use a metric for the global warming potential of methane that is old and has been updated, and in this case that lowballed the effect of methane by 25%. Another thing that they did was that they applied the 100-year standard instead of the 20-year standard for how to measure the effect. And basically what you're doing is you're saying, you know, this is how much greenhouse gases you're going to put out for the life of the project. Let's spread that out over 100 years instead of over 20 years. And so obviously you do the math, it looks like it's a lot worse if you spread it out over 20 years rather than 100 years.
For our listeners who may not be as math astute, let's take another kind of instance. It occurs to me, I don't know how many houseless people across the country are killed by the police every year. An arbitrary figure, let's say 200 a year. Now, if you measure that in the last 10 years, you get this 200 a year. But suppose we're submitting to the regulators and we say, instead, here's our measure, that it's the number of BIPOC houseless people who are killed by police averaged out over recorded history.
Yeah. It's a little more complicated than that, but conceptually that's kind of what it means. And the interesting thing to me is when I dug into this is that both the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the EPA itself cautions against using a 100-year standard for methane because methane is very short-lived and it's in the atmosphere and its greenhouse gas effects tend to drop way off after about 12 years. So it just doesn't make any sense to measure it over 100 years.
And you're talking about just the one particular project, but when you talk about junk science, you've encountered this in other instances as well. As a matter of fact, in nearly every corporate submission that I'm aware of that you've researched, you're talking about data that's outdated or that's manipulated or that's cherry-picked or that's just lacking in evidence. All of those passing themselves off as science and being accepted by regulatory agencies for the kinds of reasons we talked about before, which brings us back to these wonderful individuals who spend the effort on behalf of their community to actually do the research as part of mobilizing people. That's what you mean by junk science. Premises by the regulatory agencies to resume continued production of plastics, that's not in question. Continued practices in producing plastics and in producing the materials that go into plastic, as if pretty much we didn't have a climate change issue. And one thing that came up earlier I'd like you to address is just the continued assumption that markets provide the only kind of solution, that this is built in to the science.
Or what passes for science.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, to come back to the Kalama project, what happened after they submitted this greenhouse gas analysis that was so flawed was that the Washington State Department of Ecology kind of threw up its hands and said, all right, we're going to take this over. So they decided to produce their own analysis. And they hired three for-profit engineering and environmental and marketing firms to do this analysis. And their life cycle analysis was actually quite well done. We do not have issues with how they conducted the greenhouse gas life cycle analysis, but they come to the conclusion that this methanol refinery is going to be good for global warming by pulling out one of the same old tricks, which is they're comparing it to coal, as if coal is the only alternative that we have. And that's simply not true. They didn't even look at some of the bio-based feedstocks that can be used to produce plastics, for example. And those are more expensive, but they're also more expensive in the context of a heavily subsidized fossil fuel industry.
And potentially less expensive in terms of environmental impact.
Absolutely. So that was one problem, that same old, this is better than coal, so it's great for global warming. But the other thing that they did that I think was very egregious and disturbing is that once they did the life cycle analysis, then they laid over it this market analysis. And they used these market analyses, basically taking what's happening now in the fossil fuel energy markets, and they project those 40 years into the future, basically without taking anything into consideration very much, like whether there might be ongoing pandemics or whether there might be a worldwide economic depression. But to me, the worst of it was that the analysis very explicitly rules out taking into consideration any possible attempts at regulating, for example, phasing out or banning single-use plastics or phasing out fossil fuels. And what that says to me is that the underlying premise here is that the market is the main governing force in human society, and there's nothing we can do about that. And I find that to be a shockingly cynical stand for a regulatory agency to take.
We're having to wrap up at this point. I want to go back to the other concept of citizen scientist, the other part of what we mean by citizen. We focused a lot on the scientific investigation and the dedication of people to learn the science when they don't have that kind of training initially. Science itself doesn't furnish the answers, though, to the kinds of policy questions that really are at stake. The big questions aren't simply science questions. Science plays a role in how we decide, how we move forward. But those questions aren't answered strictly in science terms. And here's the other dimension of citizen in citizen science. Flesh out just a little bit what we mean by that. What are the kind of big questions that science fits into?
Well, science can inform us in when we're trying to make these policy questions, but really, when communities are faced with these big projects, the kinds of questions that I think they are grappling with are questions like, how do we make a decision that is just and fair to everyone? How do we decide how we want to live? How do we want to live with the natural world? What's important to us in terms of our community and the ways that we've chosen to build our community. Those are the kinds of questions that are absolutely crucial to deciding whether we're going to take these projects on. But they're not the kinds of questions that are necessarily answered by science. They can be informed by science, but they can't necessarily tell us how we should exercise our own values, our own beliefs, our own desires about the kinds of communities that we want to be. And sometimes these highly technical arguments and discussions and disputes can be a distraction from that very basic conversation about who do we want to be as a community.
Lastly, we're in suspense. When do we expect the decision on Kalama?
Well, we're expecting the Washington State Department of Ecology to rule on the shoreline permit in early December.
This has been Norm Diamond with citizen scientist Patricia Kohlberg.
Thank you, Norm.
And now, just a smidgen of Science Genius Girl by Freeze Pop.
I'm a science genius girl.